As a small business, we have always prioritized our underwriting for an HPR as one of the primary marketing investments that we make.
Jim Fitz, Managing Director of the Colony Group, a longtime business supporter of NHPR.
We find that our clients appreciate that support, and also we frequently hear that NHPR is where they first hear our name.
You can learn more on how to reach NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Amid hope provided by COVID-19 vaccines comes worrying news about a new coronavirus variant, said to be much more contagious. Meanwhile, the death toll in the United States has exceeded 400,000 since the pandemic began. Here in New Hampshire, 938 people have died, with the state reporting this week that our current test positivity rate is around 7%. Today in The Exchange, the state's top two epidemiologists are back with an update and to answer your questions. So send them in. Email us. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. Our guests are Dr. Benjamin Chan. He's the state's epidemiologist. Dr. Chan, welcome back and thank you.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy state epidemiologist and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. And Dr. Talbot, welcome back to you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having us back.
So before we begin, I do want to remind our listeners that yesterday on our show, we devoted the hour to vaccine distribution and access. Today, our focus is on health and safety information about the virus, about the vaccine. So if you are wondering about where to get vaccinated, if you're eligible, please go to our webpage at nhpr.org/exchange to either listen to yesterday's program or to see all the links and resources that we put there. So both of you, here we are, Inauguration Day, a new administration begins. Dr. Talbot, you first, please. What do you, as a public health official, hope to see from the federal government in these next few critical weeks?
More vaccine, but without a doubt. So I've very much appreciated to see the Biden administration's posted plan, several of which features mechanisms to increase vaccine production. So I think it's understandable that federally they have advocated for prioritization of those who are most vulnerable to morbidity and mortality, that is getting sick and hospitalized and dying. But we can't do it without adequate numbers of vaccine.
Yeah, that was the message that we got from our show yesterday. The state is getting ready to move into this new phase of vaccine registration. You know, the systems are being set up, websites, phone numbers, community health clinics, and so forth. But the message we also got from folks yesterday, Dr. Talbot, was we need vaccines from the federal government before we can implement this plan.
That's right. And, you know, there are other features, too, that can help us very much operationally, such as timely and transparent shipping plans. I've heard the phrase and appreciate it very much from where I sit, that we would rather that they underpromised and over-delivered. But when we don't receive the amount of vaccine we've expected, it can be extremely disruptive to our operational plans. And the trickle down is that people, of course, are disappointed and frustrated and going unvaccinated longer than anyone wants. So,
Dr. Chan, how about you? As the state's top public health official, what do you want and need from the federal government? Again, we're entering kind of a critical phase here.
Yeah, I think better communication and coordination with local public health agencies. And I think what we've seen throughout the last 10 plus months of this pandemic is a patchwork of responses across the country, with each state sort of taking a slightly different approach to different, you know, different strategies. And I think there needs to be better coordination with what is happening at local and state public health agencies across the country to come up with a better coordinated national strategy and plan in to respond to this pandemic.
I want to ask both of you about some of the latest numbers that we've been tracking, and I know you've been tracking around this pandemic. And first of all, is the positivity rate, that's around 7% right now. How should we interpret this, Dr. Chan? What does that really mean, a 7% positivity rate?
Yeah, so the positivity rate has been coming down in the last 2-3 weeks or so. you know, it peaked just over 10%, and now it's just below 7%. And I think that's good news. That's a promising trend. But the overall level still remains too high. You know, the positivity rate looks at the proportion of people that test positive out of everybody that's tested. And so when that number is high, it means that there's likely a lot of infection out in the community that we're missing. When the test positivity rate is low, it means we're doing enough testing to adequately identify infection within the community. And so the trend is promising. The overall number still remains too high. We'd like to see that certainly below 5%, and the lower the better.
And another number we've been looking at, Dr. Chan, is hospitalizations. As you know, ICU bed occupancy has risen, as have the number of people hospitalized. Where are we at, Dr. Chan, in terms of our state's ability to care for very ill people who need to be in the hospital?
Yeah, so our hospitals are still open. They're still able to provide the necessary and emergency services to people in the community. But they're certainly feeling the strain of the pandemic in terms of capacity and workforce. And, you know, this is going to vary hospital by hospital. We're on the phone on a call twice a week, in fact, with hospitals around the state assessing their condition. And so this is another area where, you know, the trend is promising, right? The daily number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 has decreased over the last couple of weeks from a high of around 330 people statewide hospitalized to around now 250. So while the trend is promising, the overall number still remains, again, too high. You know, 250 people hospitalized throughout the state is still double the number of people that were hospitalized at the peak during our first wave of the pandemic.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard other public health officials talk about slight decreases in some of these numbers, but then they compare it to the last peak in April, and it doesn't look great. And Dr. Talbot, to you, what's the danger zone in terms of healthcare system capacity? What are you looking at there?
So we've already heard from Dr. Chan that the hospitals are still functional in terms of all of their services, and that's very important to us because we know that there are indirect impacts of COVID on our population, people who are not able to get other kinds of care that they need or are reluctant to seek health care for fear of acquiring disease. I'm very proud of our hospital systems for controlling in-hospital transmission. That's just not a feature of what we see in New Hampshire. And that speaks to, you know, a tremendous effort on the part of every hospital and healthcare provider.
Have you seen, Dr. Talbot, hospitals having to adjust their care then yet at all based on, you know, the rising number of hospitalizations?
There are always shifts in the operations that hospitals undertake. So, for example, we heard that hospitals were preparing to take care of their sickest patients by expanding places where ventilators are functional. So just moving patients around, in our words, cohorting, that is keeping like ill patients together in some different wards. So we're pleased with, of course, the state adoption of eye protection, so either goggles or face shields. So lots of adjustments happen behind the scenes at hospitals. And again, I've been very gratified by the partnership between the hospitals and the state, and also their clear intentions to maintain safe and full operations.
And Dr. Chan, if this does continue to, you know, spread, as you said, and we're going to talk about the new variant in a moment, what's the plan for hospitals? Are we going to put up surge sites like the ones that we saw back in the spring outside some of the major healthcare centers, those big white tents that we saw?
Yeah, it's a good question. And one of the critical limiting resources that we have in New Hampshire, and actually nationwide, is really staffing, right? And so if we were to set up surge centers, we would need to find a way to staff those surge centers. And so right now, there's not a plan to set up surge centers, although there is always that option and that possibility. Before we would get to that point, we would look to the hospitals to shift resources, as Dr. Talbot was just talking about. And that would include probably having or hospitals making the decision to, you know, cancel elective surgeries, elective procedures, to offload the burden of patients and patient care on hospitals. And there are some hospitals that have, you know, taken that step already to start to ramp down or cancel elective surgeries because of the increased burden on healthcare systems. And so hospitals have been able to manage by shifting resources from one area to another. And likely we would look to hospitals to implement more steps like that before we talk about opening surge centers. But certainly that remains an option if things get very dire in the future.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned staffing, because you can have those tents, but you also need people to work them. So that's an important point. I want to remind our listeners that we are talking with the state's top epidemiologist today about the pandemic, what they're looking at right now here in New Hampshire, what they're hoping for, and we're taking your questions. What do you want to know about the pandemic here in the Granite State? The latest health and science information, how the pandemic is spreading here in New Hampshire. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook. You can call 800-892-6477. And Dr. Chan Marie in Hopkinton writes, please tell us why Johns Hopkins positivity rate is at 10.4%, and Dr. Chan is giving us a lower rate. Marie, thank you. Dr. Chan, we've talked about this before, so go ahead, please.
Yeah, so I think what the person is talking about is Johns Hopkins report on New Hampshire data. And I would point people to our data as probably the most accurate. You know, a lot of these other sites outside of New Hampshire are pulling or scraping data that we normally report. And so it's going to vary depending on what you include in the numbers. You know, when we talk about a 7% test positivity, we're talking about that being a 7-day average, so averaged out over 7 days, and looking at both antigen and PCR tests combined. So I can't speak to exactly what Johns Hopkins is reporting because I don't have those numbers in front of me, but it is important to look at whether we're talking about a single-day test positivity versus a 7-day average. And when you're comparing state to state, it's important to look at, you know, does the state include just PCR tests or PCR and antigen tests as we do in New Hampshire?
I want to ask both of you about the new variant or variants, and I'll let you tell me. And Dr. Talbot, to you first, please. Can you describe this new strain of COVID-19 that we've been hearing about for a couple weeks that was first uncovered in the UK?
The virus under investigation, or virus of concern, as it's called in these scientific circles, it's emerged that the B117 nomenclature probably gets us on the same page. Others refer to it as the UK strain. It's a bit false at this point, but it did emerge in Southeast England in September, noting, you know, a very dramatic rise in the number of cases there. The genetic analysis of that virus showed that it does have mutations compared with the parent strain, that is, changes in its genetic recipe. And some of those changes are in the so-called spike protein. So everybody's seen that graphic out there with those red knobs on it. Yeah. Those knobs are the spike proteins, and they facilitate the virus's uptake into our own cells. So it's an extremely important part of the virus. And seeing those spike proteins adapt to be more efficient in uptake is concerning. It's already in more than 50 countries, and December 29th, it was first reported in the United States in Colorado, importantly, in a person who had not traveled and had no contact to someone who had traveled. So as it's emerged in the U.S., there are now 76 cases reported in 12 states, and it's possible that it's a bit more widespread than that.
This is what viruses do, right, Dr. Talbot?
Right.
Should we really be surprised by this? Viruses mutate and change.
Well, that's exactly right. So all organisms make small mistakes in replication. Viruses are famous for this. HIV is one of the worst. It's very sloppy. Flu is very sloppy, and that's why we have to get a flu shot each year. When it replicates itself, it's a bit careless. So the coronavirus has shown itself as also having this propensity, making some mistakes along the way, and some of the mistakes are favorable to the virus, and so they're selected for, if you will. They have a selective advantage. So you're right. This is normal for viruses. But we certainly hope that the mistakes that it makes doesn't favor the virus over the human. And here we have a virus that now is shown to be more transmissible, again, by virtue of the fact the spike protein is adapted.
Disappointing news after there was some excitement at the beginning of the year over the rollout of these vaccines. And speaking of the vaccines, Dr. Chan, how effective are the two vaccines that we have right now in this country against this new strain? Do we know?
So we haven't seen good, solid data to give a number for vaccine efficacy against this new UK variant or the B117 strain. What we do know about this new variant, this new strain of the virus, is, as Dr. Talbot mentioned, it appears to be more infectious, more transmissible person to person because of this these mutations in the spike protein. But there is not evidence that it causes more severe disease or more death, and there is not evidence that immunity from prior infection to a different strain or immunity from vaccination is less in this new strain. The concerning thing about this B117 strain that was first identified in the UK is that it's, you know, at maybe approximately 50%+ more infectious, more transmissible.
Yikes.
When it gets into a population, it can spread more easily, more people will become infected. That greater number of people will lead to more hospitalizations, more deaths. But there's not evidence right now that the vaccine is less effective against this new strain. I should mention there are other strains, as you alluded to, that are emerging on the global level. There's a strain that was identified out of South Africa, and this goes by the identifier B1351. And there's another one out of Brazil, P as in pumpkin 1, I believe, is the nomenclature that's being used. And there's much less known about these variants, these other variants. They haven't yet been identified in the U.S. It's only the UK variant that's been identified in the U.S., but we're still studying to learn how the vaccine might protect against not only the UK variant, but also these other emerging variants around the globe.
Well, I have a couple more questions about these new variants and how they interact with the vaccine, but let's go to our listeners, and JJ in Pembroke is calling in. Hi, JJ. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm a physician. I've retired many years ago and have been doing advocacy for Public Health Association. And I'm part of the task force that the Public Health Association and the Office of Health Equity put together last spring. And one of our subgroups, which I'm part of, has focused on prisons and jails, and it's been very difficult to get much attention to this problem, and now we have some major outbreaks. And I'm wondering how we're going to help do more to protect all of us, actually, because just as with other things, the spread into the community from prisons and jails and the demand on resources if people should start getting deathly ill from those outbreaks is really important.
JJ, it's really good to hear from you, especially given the work that you're doing in this area. And Dr. Talbot, to you first, I think his concerns about institutional outbreaks at correctional facilities, long-term care facilities, other settings that we've seen. Go ahead, Dr. Talbot, your thoughts there on JJ's call.
Well, indeed, thank you, JJ. The outbreaks that we are observing in the corrections are, of course, concerning. And again, I speak to the importance of partnership with the Department of Corrections and the staff there to make sure that all the infection control processes are appropriately in place, and I'm sure they are. We also know that the facilities are very actively looking to bring vaccine on-site or mechanisms for such for those persons who are appropriate within our phase 1B. So, for example, those who are older than 65 and older, or those who have medical comorbidities are certainly appropriately able to access vaccines. So establishing the partnerships and the mechanisms are a very important part of what we're doing right now. You're absolutely right that these the virus takes advantage of congregate settings of all types. So thank you for raising that issue.
Well, and to that point, Dr. Chan, you know, Dr. Talbot said it best, the virus does take advantage of congregate settings. Is that an argument, Dr. Chan, for vaccinating all prisoners, not just those who have health conditions or who are over 65?
Yeah, so if I can just make the point before I answer that question that in the first wave of this pandemic, we saw very few, if any, large prisoner jail outbreaks. And so I just want to make the point that what happens in the community affects all of our institutions, whether that's, you know, prisons and jails, long-term care facilities, you know, public schools, our workplaces, our ability to conduct, you know, activities of daily living. And so it's really on all of us to make sure that the levels of community transmission go down, and when they go down, remain low, because if we don't, we have situations like what we're seeing in our community outbreaks and long-term care facilities outbreaks at prisons and jails. And we want to avoid the virus getting into these congregate living settings where we know it can spread very easily. You know, so to your question, yes, we want to get vaccine out to everybody in the state. You know, that includes, you know, staff at prisons and jails, that includes residents at prisons and jails. But the reality of the situation is that we are getting about 17,000 to 18,000 doses of vaccine per week, and we have hundreds of thousands of people that need the vaccine. And so we're in this situation that, you know, nobody or many people are not happy about, where not everybody can get the vaccine that wants it, and not everybody that we want to give the vaccine to is able to get it. And so as a state, we have made the decision to prioritize delivery of vaccine to those who are at most at risk of severe disease, you know, people over the age of 65, people with multiple medical comorbidities or medical health conditions. And that includes people wherever they may be, whether, you know, they're working, they're in a long-term care facility, they're in a jail or prison. If they meet those criteria as being at higher risk for severe COVID-19, they can get vaccinated. But we have taken that approach to prioritization instead of prioritizing specific populations or essential workers, for example.
Let's take another call. This is Anne in Pembroke. Hi, Anne. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm a resident of New York. My husband and I had the virus in April. My husband passed away. I survived. Now I'm in New Hampshire with my daughter and grandchildren. I am not a resident. Will I be able to get the vaccine in New Hampshire, or do I go back to New York?
Oh, Anne, I'm sorry about your husband. That's a terrible thing. That's a terrible thing. And I just spoke to a friend last night whose mother died of COVID.
It's a terrible virus. Terrible virus.
And I'm so sorry. And I'm glad you've got your, you know, your daughter and grandchildren to be with you. Yesterday, we focused all on, you know, who and how and registration and so forth. But Dr. Chan, very quickly, can somebody who's living here, not a permanent New Hampshire resident, but living here right now, get the vaccine if she's over 74?
Yeah, and thanks, Anne, for that question. And I'm sorry also to hear about your husband and to hear what you and your family have gone through. I think this is a question that we have started to get. And I think there are some issues here that we still need to work through as a state. And there have been situations where people have, you know, driven up from another state to try and get vaccinated in New Hampshire, and we are not allowing that. And part of the reason that we have to be restrictive on who we give the vaccine to in terms of out-of-state residents is the federal government is allocating vaccine to states based on their persons, based on the population and where a person lives. So, for example, Anne, in your case, the federal government is giving your vaccine to the state of New York, I believe, to have on hand to give to you.
I see.
Right. So when these numbers, this becomes a number game, when we look at the numbers, you know, we are being given vaccine by the federal government to vaccinate as many people as we have listed as residents in the state of New Hampshire. And so this gets into a difficult situation where we are aware of people that have been, you know, moved to New Hampshire and have been living here for months and months, possibly. But the official residence is in another state. And unfortunately, we don't have that vaccine that has been allocated to New Hampshire for people that are residents of other states. And so I think the short answer is that right now, the vaccine would not be available to people that are residents of other states, but these are issues that we continue to hear about and we'll need to continue to work through as we hear about these types of situations.
I have another question about the new variant for you, Dr. Talbot. Given this new variant, given what you and Dr. Chan have told us about how much more transmissible it is, do we need new mask guidelines? Because as I'm sure you know, in other countries, they're starting to say, look, these regular reusable cloth masks do not provide sufficient protection against this new COVID-19 variant.
Clearly, we need appropriate attention to masks that are of the quality that we described previously. And it's 2-ply at least, a surgical grade or medical grade is likely better than the homemade mask because of the way that it can shield the side. So we are very happy to revisit issues of what makes a good mask. You know, we've all seen masks that maybe fashionable, but are not well-fitting, and they're sliding down over the nose, and they require very frequent hand adjustment and such. The phenomenon of gaiters, where maybe they're 1-ply and again, don't seal up the exhaled breath, for example. So we are all about making sure people are wearing the right mask all the time, whether we have this variant or not. But you're right, that may press us. I wanted to make one more comment about the variants, which
sure.
The mRNA platform has been intentionally chosen because it is probably one of the ways, one of the best vaccine strategies that changes quickly. So if we were to find that the current messenger RNA vaccines were not a perfect match kind of thing, then we're assured that the scientists could make changes to that vaccine very quickly. So I wanted to give you that background because I find that very strategic and helpful in my understanding of our dependence on these mRNA vaccines right now. So
the mRNA platform, Dr. Talbot, is sort of the formulation of these new vaccines. And I'm glad you said that because I have read that too, that, you know, these vaccines could be altered to respond if necessary. But it has been, you know, we've seen this, the scientists approved and tested and created these so quickly, but there's all these backlogs in terms of production and distribution. So in a way, it's reassuring to hear that the vaccines could be altered. But in a way, Dr. Talbot, I wonder, would we run into the same situation with an altered vaccine?
You're right, of course, that this won't happen on a dime. But I think, again, the encouragement I get from it is that it can certainly happen faster than, for example, our flu vaccine strategy, where we have to get chickens to lay eggs and then grow it up. And, you know, that's not nimble. But the mRNA and other genetic vaccine strategies are ones that at least the recipe can change extremely quickly and then production changes and would not require the same degree of FDA, CDC, Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices review. It would be a trivial change that would be as fast as possible in terms of redeployment.
And Dr. Chan, in terms of your office of public health, what are you guys going to start telling Granite Staters about the quality of their masks, given, again, lots of discussion in this country and new rules coming out in other countries saying, you need better masks, folks. This new variant is strong.
So I think there's a couple issues there. And I think that the more key issue is just getting people to wear masks in the first place. As I'm sure you and your listeners are aware, there's continues to be a statewide mask mandate. And so we continue to encourage people to cover up their nose and mouth both, you know, sometimes you see people wearing masks over the over their mouth but not their nose. Right, a mask needs to be well fitted and go over both the nose and mouth, the nose and mouth. And those masks are intended to prevent a person's respiratory droplets from spreading to other people. But there's also likely some protection that those masks offer individuals. The CDC does have guidance for what is considered an acceptable mask. You know, a mask should be, you know, well fit around the nose and mouth. As Dr. Talbot alluded to, the more layers, the better. So, you know, a two or even three layered mask is better than a one layered mask. And then what's a little bit less clear, but worth some attention, is that the material of the mask is also likely of importance. So some of these store-bought masks that are made out of, I think, polypropylene may be better than homemade masks because of the material and the ability of that material to filter particles and droplets. And some of these materials also have an electrostatic charge to them, which helps to trap the moisture droplets that people are either breathing in or exhaling. And so some of these store-bought masks that are multiple layers and you know, fit snugly around the nose and mouth are probably going to be better than homemade cloth masks that might only be one layer. But the effectiveness of some of these masks, I think, we don't have good numbers or good data on. And I think it comes down to simply getting people to wear masks in the first place and practice the social distancing, avoiding group gatherings. These are still the primary ways that we have to control and prevent spread of COVID-19.
I did get an email from Larry, Dr. Chan, about asking about the relative benefits or deficiencies of different types of face coverings, surgical cloth, bandanas, neck pull-ups, etc. I have been seeing, Dr. Chan, more and more places saying the neck pull-up isn't good enough. What about that?
Yeah, so I think that we would certainly support businesses and organizations in taking that stance, because I think we believe that those kind of neck pull-ups likely are not as good as a store-bought, you know, three-layer, you know, fitted mask that has ear loops and, you know, that goes over the nose and, you know, crimps over the nose as well. The better the form fit, the better the fit, the more layers, likely the better the mask is at preventing spread of droplets. So, you know, just putting that out there, that likely there are some masks that are inferior to others. And so we recommend the better form-fitting masks that have multiple layers of fabric. But not everybody may be able to buy those masks, you know, or to go to the store and purchase them. And if that's the case, then, you know, wearing some mask is better than wearing no mask.
Well, again, I want to let listeners know that on our show yesterday, we focused on vaccine registration. That is not our focus today, but you can find out if you're in a qualifying group, and then if you are, to register to get vaccinated at vaccines.nh.gov or by calling 211. Now, coming up, we're going to find out how these vaccines work, what you need to know. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, where does New Hampshire stand right now with the pandemic? Yesterday, we focused on vaccine registration and distribution. For more on that, go to nhpr.org/exchange. This hour, our focus is on the latest health and science as we talk with the state's top epidemiologists. Listeners, what are your questions about the coronavirus here in New Hampshire? Send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. And Dr. Talbot, we got lots of questions from listeners about the impacts of vaccination. John wrote, he says, isn't it true that getting the vaccination does not keep you from getting, carrying, and transmitting the virus? It keeps you from coming down with the virus and getting sick, but we still need to keep social distance, wear a mask, limit travel. Is that true? Beth also has a similar question. I'd like to hear from the good doctors their recommendations about this. I'm due soon for my second Moderna shot. Like everyone, I'm aching to be with my family I haven't seen in months, especially my only grandchild, who is 1 year old. How safe is it for me to visit them in Vermont a couple weeks after getting my second vaccine? And if it's okay to be indoors, should we all continue to wear masks? We've gotten lots of questions like this from our listeners, Dr. Talbot. If somebody's been fully vaccinated, both doses, can they still spread the virus to somebody else?
Simply put, we don't know. The trials for the mRNA vaccines were shown to be efficacious on the basis of, you know, they worked to prevent symptomatic disease. They simply didn't study whether the vaccines were preventing asymptomatic carriage and therefore the potential of spreading to other people, So you see, we don't know the answer. It's not that they don't. But we have science coming to us on a very regular basis, suggesting such, and we're very hopeful. We want everyone to get their second dose of vaccine. 14 days after their second dose, we believe you have achieved your protection from this vaccine, or either vaccine, and therefore we do have some changes within our state policy regarding how you participate in some of the community mitigation strategies we've talked about so many times before, and I know Dr. Chan wants to talk about that.
Yeah, I just want to add that no vaccine is going to be 100%, right, 100% effective. And so we know that even people who were previously infected can become reinfected again. And we suspect, although as Dr. Talbot mentioned, we don't have good solid data on this, we suspect that even people who are fully vaccinated could likely pick up infection and spread it to other people. Again, this is something that's still being studied. We know that the vaccines are very effective at preventing symptomatic COVID-19, but how effective they are at preventing asymptomatic infection and spread, we just don't know. And so even people that are fully vaccinated need to continue to practice all of the recommended mitigation strategies. We continue to discourage non-essential travel. We continue to discourage, you know, social and group gatherings with people outside of the immediate household. People continue to need to practice social distancing and wear face masks when around other people. All of these measures still apply even for people that are fully vaccinated because we just don't know how effective the vaccines are at preventing reinfection, asymptomatic reinfection or carriage of the virus, and then possibly spread to other people. We're still learning about the virus. We're still learning about the vaccines. The vaccines ultimately, I think, are going to be our way out of this pandemic. But right now, until we have a high level of coverage population-wide with the vaccine, everybody needs to continue to practice all of the recommended community mitigation measures, even those who are fully vaccinated.
So what does that mean, Dr. Chan, for the bigger picture, the, you know, so deeply desired return to normal that everybody is seeking, the herd immunity that we're all longing for? What does what you just said mean for that vision?
So I think that this is going to be a process, right? And it's going to be a process that plays out over months. As we go through the different phases of vaccination, as we get more vaccine available in the state and can make it more readily available, there will be a point, and we can't predict when that point will be, that we are able to relax restrictions further. But that time is not now because of the low level of vaccine coverage throughout the state. So I will also make mention that people who are fully vaccinated, we are saying do not need to quarantine if re-exposed, but everybody still needs to practice those mitigation measures. But we don't want vaccination to be seen as a free pass to travel, to, you know, gathering groups, to meet with other people that, you know, you wouldn't normally meet with now if you weren't vaccinated, right? So there are reasons and benefits to getting the vaccine. Going to protect you. It's going to likely protect those around you. It's going to, you know, prevent someone from needing to re-quarantine if they're exposed, or to quarantine if they're re-exposed again. But all the other mitigation measures remain, you know, in place and recommended even for people fully vaccinated.
Here's a question from Kathy that just came in. Dr. Talbot, I'll throw it to you. How effective will getting just one shot be for those getting vaccinated?
Thanks, Kathy. We have limited data. I hate to have that as my theme for every answer I provide, but in fact, the manufacturers of these vaccines didn't set out to test one dose. They set out to test both. So we have some small groups of people who only got one, that they measured the degree of protection they had. And it looks like there is some protection after one dose, maybe 50% for the Pfizer-BioNTech presentation of vaccine, and the number we have is 80% for Moderna. I want to say again that those were small numbers of people, so there's not so much confidence in those numbers. And then the other important feature of that was one point in time, and we have every expectation that if you get one dose of vaccine, it's likely that will not be durable protection, that even compromised amount of protection is going to go away faster than if you get both doses.
So you need that booster shot, as it's been called, Dr. Talbot.
Really do. And therefore, we're being very transparent with everyone regarding the fact that we expect these vaccines to create side effects that suggest your immune system is activated. So that soreness at the arm, maybe some fatigue and headache and even fever in some proportion of people with that first dose. And it may be more for the second dose. So we want people to go into it knowing that risk-benefit is favorable and that we expect these side effects. But in general, it's going to be really favorable for durable protection to go ahead and plan for that second dose.
Okay, so Dr. Chan, that raises another question. Given the shortages that you and everybody else have talked about, that New Hampshire and other states haven't gotten as many vaccines as they thought from the federal government, what does that mean for someone who got their first shot but now is waiting for the second shot? If they wait too long, does the whole thing kind of fall apart?
The short answer is no. And we have been assured second doses will be available to people that need second doses. But even if someone's second dose is delayed for whatever reason, they can and should still get the second dose as soon as possible after their sort of due date for that second dose. And there's no need to restart the series, right? So the time frame between the first and the second dose is going to vary depending upon which vaccine somebody gets. The time frame for the Pfizer vaccine, second dose is given 21 days after the first dose. With a Moderna vaccine, it's 28 days. But even if somebody is, 30, 60 days out from their first dose, they can still get that second dose. They should just get it as close to that date that they're supposed to get the second dose as possible.
All right. Well, coming up, we will have more information about how the vaccines work. We'll take more of your questions. I also want to remind listeners that if you're curious about whether you're eligible for the next phase of vaccine registration, distribution, you can go to the state website at vaccines.nh.gov. Registration starts on Friday morning. You can also call 211 if you don't have good internet access. So that's information that's important for you to know as well. We'll take more of your calls and emails in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Stay with NHPR for live coverage throughout the day as Joe Biden is sworn in as president. We'll join the BBC at 10 for a global perspective, and then at 11, it's NPR special coverage. And then, of course, Thursday morning on The Exchange, we'll get New Hampshire reaction to Inauguration Day. Right now, we're talking with the state's top two epidemiologists, Dr. Benjamin Chan and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, about the latest with the pandemic here in New Hampshire. And we've been hearing from you. You can send us your comments by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can call 800-892-6477. And let's start out with a call. Kate's calling from Plymouth. Hi, Kate. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. My question is about nursing homes. My mother is in a nursing home, and she's received both her shots. But the nursing home is still saying she's not allowed to leave, to come to our home, to go to lunch, have her hair cut, et cetera. So I want to know what the state stance is on that. It feels like it's gone from protection at the nursing home to cruelty by not letting them still see their families.
Oh, Kate, I'm glad you called. And it's great, Dr. Chan, that her mother got both doses already. That's fantastic. But yeah, some frustration there. What's the, you know, her mom's been vaccinated and she needs to get out.
Yeah, and thank you for that question. This is an issue we continue to hear frustration around. And I will say, I will sort of echo what was previously said, that this is a process, right? And so it's great that people are getting vaccinated. It's great that they're getting two doses of the vaccine, but no vaccine is going to be 100%. And we're still learning about the effectiveness of these vaccines to prevent asymptomatic infection and transmission after being fully vaccinated. And so we are taking a slow, stepwise approach to relaxing restrictions. And so that includes that with long-term care facilities, a lot of the restrictions that have been in place are remaining in place for the time being, even for people that are fully vaccinated. That doesn't mean that people cannot have visitors, that people can't leave the long-term care facilities, you know, that those, you know, visitation and, you know, people going out out of the facility remain a possibility, and that's going to vary somewhat facility by facility. But getting vaccinated, again, is not a free pass to letting all restrictions down. And so there still needs to be some caution and precautions in place against someone who, even somebody who's fully vaccinated, being re-exposed, possibly picking up the virus asymptomatically and bringing it back into the long-term care facility that could then perpetuate another outbreak, especially among people that are not fully vaccinated. So there still need to be precautions in place. And I think that that's part of the frustration that people are seeing is that, you know, yes, people should be fully vaccinated, but that's not a free pass to, you know, letting all restrictions down.
Wow. Dr. Talbot, it's almost like it's only half the puzzle. So Kate's mom probably won't get COVID now. That's good. But she still doesn't know if mom will transmit it to other people, including Kate herself. And that's extremely frustrating, especially 10 months into this thing. And we've seen the psychosocial impacts on elderly people, kids, everybody, but, you know, especially the elderly shut up in their rooms sometimes for months on end. So it's almost like we need this other piece of the puzzle before we can celebrate, Dr. Talbot.
Yeah, I definitely hear that frustration on a daily basis. I'm also aware that those who work and care for people like Kate's mother are very frustrated, and we all want to be out of this now. And it's just one of the most dynamic spaces of our transition. You know, again, I do think that this is light at the end of this long, dark tunnel, but how long is the time in the tunnel yet? And I hear that. I want to tell you that we are very actively engaged with the long-term care facilities, licensed facilities, working together to make rational, evidence-based decisions on behalf of all the residents who are most vulnerable to illness and death here. I would offer the intersection of what we recommend with also what the CMS is advising these licensed facilities. That's a federal agency that dictates how they are able to allow visitation or others too. So we're on a balancing act there between what decisions we can take locally and what's being dictated from on high.
And here's an email from Carol. Dr. Chan, I'll throw it to you. How do you check to see if someone is having a reaction to the vaccine if it's done as a drive-through? We got this question yesterday too, Dr. Chan, but it's important. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think it's important to differentiate between different types of reactions. Some are normal expected reactions or side effects from the vaccine, but I think what the person is maybe, what Carol is maybe referring to is allergic reactions. And so, you know, everybody that gets the vaccine is going to be monitored for 15, maybe 30 minutes after receiving the vaccine, even at these drive-through vaccination locations. So there are safety processes that have been set up at these drive-through vaccination clinics to make sure that people have the ability and are appropriately monitored for 15 to 30 minutes after receiving the vaccine, per, you know, which is in line and consistent with, you know, federal guidelines about how to safely implement these vaccines. But I do want to mention that people can expect some normal side effects after vaccine, after receiving the vaccine, that are not considered allergic reactions, you know, in the 1 to 2 days after receiving the vaccine. This can include local injection site reactions like pain and redness and swelling, and even potentially systemic reactions, side effects to the vaccine, headaches, muscle aches, fatigue, even fever and chills have been reported in the 1 or 2 days after receiving the vaccine. These are normal vaccine side effects that have been reported. And even if somebody has these types of side effects, they still can and should get their second dose of the vaccine. I think what we're talking about primarily are allergic reactions like anaphylaxis, hives, body rashes, that sort of thing that should potentially prompt further evaluation. But there is a monitoring period to look out for these reactions after vaccination. But certainly somebody could have an allergic reaction in the hours after they receive the vaccine. And so if someone does have an allergic type reaction, they should be on their phone with their primary care provider, or for more serious allergic reactions, which are rare, by the way, you know, seek more urgent care, you know, through an emergency department, for example.
You know, Dr. Talbot, the last time we talked, we were in the middle of the holiday season. We talked after Thanksgiving, but before Christmas, and you and other doctors were very worried about gatherings as a source of transmission, as college kids came home, as extended families gathered for Christmas. What does the data show, Dr. Talbot, about whether those fears were realized?
We are indeed hearing anecdotally that persons who participated in gatherings are recognizing those as potential points of transmission. So the data is still being realized from those events of Christmas and New Year, which, by the way, in COVID time seemed to me like a lifetime ago.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know, and I guess I'd like to hearken too to the fact that when we talked last, we were just getting the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine, and look what's happened in a month. You know, we're really rolling with that. And in that spirit, I also want people to know that there are two more vaccines that are likely to be coming to us, and this could greatly alleviate some of the challenges we have with regards to delivering to everybody in a timely way. So the Novavax and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines might be coming to us in the next months. So there's certainly more on the horizon that's going to get us out of this, you know, terrible time together.
What has the data shown us, Dr. Talbot, about where most of the transmission is happening? I get that, you know, there's community spread sort of everywhere, but what does the data tell us about the behavior we really should avoid? Is it a small gathering, whether with family or friends? You know, we've got Super Bowl coming up, so people are going to want to have their traditional Super Bowl party. Is it restaurants? Is it schools? As you know, in some countries, the schools and the stores are open, but the bars and restaurants are closed. So what do we know, Dr. Talbot? Where is this spread really happening?
We still believe that that it's close contact without masks in closed spaces. That's the risk. And so you've described a Super Bowl party pretty well, for the most part, because people are eating and drinking and close together on the couch and jumping up and down and making forceful, you know, utterings for their team, et cetera. So that is of concern. Schools, we have not seen a lot of in-classroom transmission, and that's to the credit of our school partners who have worked hard to increase social distancing and enforce masking in difficult circumstances and et cetera. Restaurants are another place, bars are another place where people generally are there because they are going to unmask to consume, yeah? And these are closed spaces where people are in close contact, often face-to-face. So indeed, as this pandemic emerges, some of these gatherings clearly appear higher risk than others.
Dr. Chan, looking back, what do you hope that state public health officials have learned over the past year about, you know, your role in educating the public about this unprecedented disease? What did you learn from 2020, and how are you going to apply that to 2021, Dr. Chan?
Yeah, I think one of the there have been a lot of difficulties around this pandemic, but I think one of the things that this has really highlighted is the need for intensive, targeted communication, right? We're learning about the virus. We're now learning about the vaccines. our partners in the community need to be informed. The public needs to be informed. Everybody throughout the state needs to be informed about what's going on with the pandemic, with the virus, with the vaccines. And that's a huge effort that we will continue to put resources into to make sure that people have the most accurate, updated information so that they can take action, protect themselves, protect their communities, protect their family, get vaccinated. That continues to be an ongoing effort that remains, I think, critically important.
Well, both of you, we have run out of time, but we will talk to you again soon. For now, thank you for being with us. Dr. Chan, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Benjamin Chan. He's the state's epidemiologist. And Dr. Talbot, good to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy epidemiologist and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer Christina Phillips. And I want to remind you to stay with NHPR for live coverage throughout the day today as Joe Biden is sworn in as the 46th president of the United States. We'll be joining the BBC coming up in just a minute at 10 for a global perspective. And then at 11, we'll go to NPR's special coverage of the inauguration. Of course, on Thursday morning in the Exchange, we'll be getting a New Hampshire reaction to the inauguration, including your thoughts. So join us for that tomorrow morning, live at 9. For now, thanks for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.